One for Mum, one for Dad, and one for the country.
And there has never been a more exciting time to be an Australian.
Budgets are about choices, Fran, and you show what you value through the choices you make.
Dead, buried, cremated.
This is coal. Don't be afraid. Don't be scared.
Australia's basically done for. We'll just end up being a third-rate economy. You know, a banana republic.
How good is Australia?
Just...
G'day and welcome to Follow the Money, the Australia Institute's podcast demystifying the big economic issues in Australia and putting them in plain English. I'm Ebony Bennett, Deputy Director at the Australia Institute, and today I'm delighted to bring you a conversation with Professor Ross Garnaut, economist and author of the new book Reset, which explores the opportunity Australia has to reset its economy in the wake of the pandemic and why the old approaches simply will not work. This episode was recorded live on Wednesday, the 24th of February, and things may have changed since recording.
G'day, everyone. Welcome to the Australia Institute's webinar series. I'm Ebony Bennett, Deputy Director at the Australia Institute, and we're so glad to have you all along with us today. I'd like to begin by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land on which I live and work. Canberra is Ngunnawal country, and they're the traditional owners of this land. And I'd like to pay my respects to elders past and present. I acknowledge that sovereignty was never ceded and that this always was and always will be Aboriginal land. So today we're talking to Professor Ross Garnaut, economist and author of the new book Reset, which explores the opportunities Australia has to reset its economy in the wake of the pandemic and why the old approaches aren't going to work. Last year, the Institute spoke to Professor Ross Garnaut about some of the Centre for Future Work's research on the opportunities for Australian manufacturing through transitioning away from fossil fuels. And this book, too, develops the ideas in that space and the opportunities of Australia becoming a renewable energy superpower, which was also the title of Ross's last book. But today he'll also be talking about the essential role of truth, trust in politics, and calls for replacing the corporate income tax with a tax on cash flows, amongst other ideas, all of which connect directly to issues facing Parliament as we speak, whether that's about accountability, the debate around raising the rate of job seeker, or the gas-fired recovery. Ross Garnaut is Professorial Research Fellow in Economics at the University of Melbourne. In 2008, you might remember he produced the Garnaut Climate Change Review for the Australian Government, and he's the author of many books, including the best-selling Superpower, as discussed, all of which have come from Black Ink Books. And he'll be in conversation today with our Chief Economist, Richard Dennis. Welcome, Professor Garnaut. Thank you so much for joining us. Welcome, Richard.
Thanks, Ebony. Hello,
Ebony. Good to be back in Canberra after a year.
So your book title talks about the pandemic recession, Ross, but you're quite clear from the very first pages that the Australian economy was performing pretty poorly long before the pandemic hit our shores. Can you tell us about what you describe as the dog days and why we don't just want to snap back to how things were?
Yes, so Australia had 28 years of economic growth unbroken by recession from 1991 until the pandemic recession hit in the first half of last year. But it wasn't a uniform or uniformly prosperous 28 years. I divided it into three periods. The first period, the productivity boom during the 90s up to about 2002, where we got rising incomes, rising output per person, very rapidly growing productivity, faster than any other country in the developed world. That was the productivity boom, the first decade. The second decade was the China resources boom, where incomes kept growing in Australia, overwhelmingly from growth in prices of the minerals and energy that we export and investment in those industries. Productivity growth wasn't strong, but incomes rose because of the China resources boom. China's model of economic growth changed from from about 2013, and we entered the dog days. We kept growing through the dog days, but almost all of the growth was population growth from a higher rate of immigration. We had the lowest growth in output per person in the developed world, lower even than Japan, which is pretty amazing when you point it out to Australians, because a lot of Australians are accustomed to thinking of Japan as a bit of an economic basket case. Well, if Japan was a basket case, we were a lower level of basket. Of course, Japan isn't a basket case, but that's a different question. So during the period 2013 to 2019, those 7 years leading up to the pandemic, output per person didn't increase in Australia, unlike other developed countries. Average incomes of ordinary people actually fell. Real per capita household income was pretty stagnant, but that includes quite strong rises at the top of the income distribution. So and there were falls for the median, the lower half of the income distribution. So these were pretty bad times. And so I think it's a very unattractive thing to aim to get back to what we had before. We've got to do better than that, and we can do better than that.
Yeah, so you've got a whole bunch of policy prescriptions in the book that we'll get into in a minute. But I did just want to pick up on one of the ones that you kind of talked a lot about with your last book, which is the superpower opportunity. Can you tell us a little bit about what that opportunity is for Australia and why now is, you know, the most imperative time to do it?
Well, the whole world moving to zero emissions is an imperative, very important for the whole world, but more important for Australia than any other developed country, because we're the most vulnerable to climate change of all developed countries. That's been a constant for a long time. Reducing emissions reduces the rate of increase in trend temperatures. It doesn't actually reduce trend temperatures. It's only when we get to zero emissions that the forcing that leads to higher temperatures ceases to grow. So zero emissions has to be the objective. In Superpower, the book I put out at the end of 2019, I put it out that a world of zero emissions is a very good world for Australia economically for two big reasons. One is we've got a richer endowment of natural resources for renewable energy than any other developed country. Per capita is what matters in international trade terms, and we're very much richer in our combinations of wind and solar resources than other developed countries, or for that matter, most of the developing world. So that in a zero emissions world economy, where all economies are having to use zero emissions processes to produce energy, to produce manufactured goods, we should have a powerful competitive advantage. Of course, we can always muck it up by bad policy or an ignorant business leadership. But if we don't muck it up, we're the low-cost energy producer of the world, and that gives us very large advantages in energy-using industries. And in particular, the processing of Australian minerals uses a lot of energy. In the world in which minerals were processed from energy or from carbon or hydrocarbons using fossil energy, sure, we had rich coal and gas resources, but they didn't give us an industrial advantage because these goods are tradable. Once we started exporting gas from Gladstone, Australian domestic gas prices in eastern Australia rose to international levels. Once we stopped giving the electricity commissions of Queensland, New South Wales, Victoria privileged access to coal resources and made it all exportable, the costs of coal for electricity were no lower in Australia than in the countries that import our coal, Japan, Korea, China. With the very big industry, our biggest export industry, iron ore, one of our biggest export industries, metallurgical coal for turning iron ore into into iron and steel. We've got the best metallurgical coal resources in the world, but we didn't have an advantage for industry from that, because it was just as cheap to use Australian coal in Kobe or Shanghai as it was in Whyalla, cheaper actually, comparing the transport costs. So that wasn't an advantage, but it is an advantage with renewable energy, because when the whole world has to have zero emissions energy, it will not be economic to take Australian renewable energy, either by cable or in the form of hydrogen or hydrogen carriers, to countries to use it for manufacturing purposes. It will be much cheaper to process Australian minerals in Australia. The other very big advantage is that we've got far more land and woodland and coast per head of population than any other developed country. The difference is huge. And I've got a chart on that in Superpower. In the world of zero emissions, that's going to have huge value from two points of view. Sequestering, capturing carbon in soils and plants will have huge value. That's negative emissions, and the world's going to need a lot of that. And in a world of trading rights to emit carbon in a zero emissions world, we'd be exporting a lot of permits from use of our land, a lot of our plants. The natural Australian acacias and eucalypts are highly suited for these purposes. And in the zero emissions world, we won't be using coal or gas or petroleum for making plastics and manufactures. To the extent you need carbon and hydrocarbon for that, for chemical purposes, we'll be using biomass, and we'll have a big advantage and a sustainable one. So we'll do very well in that world. Now, in the challenge we face today in Australia, we're going to need a lot of growth in investment in and production in our export industries to achieve full employment and rising incomes. We're going to have growth in exports faster than growth in output if we're going to have rising incomes. And a lot of our old export industries will be blocked. Fossil energy is 22% of our exports. That's actually going to decline. Coal will decline. Gas will hold. And so that the superpower opportunities, not only a path to full employment incomes growth, I think that in the world we're facing now, they're the only path.
The only path. That's quite an imperative, and I think a bit of a change of tune from when it was one of perhaps many paths that we had open to us a while back, but perhaps we've squandered the time that we had to deal with some of these things. So I'll just tell people this is what the book looks like, Reset. It should be available in all good bookstores across Australia now. Thanks to everyone for letting us know about some of the echoes that we had. Richard, just letting you know, we think that was, because you need to mute yourself when you're not speaking. Much appreciated. Richard, I'll come to you just quickly if you can unmute yourself for a minute now. Talking about those opportunities. Oh, I think we're going to get that echo problem again. I'll come back to you, Ross. The next thing that I was going to ask about is you mentioned there returning to full employment, the fact that due to the pandemic recession and the way that we've closed our borders, we're not going to have, for example, high rates of immigration that we've been able to rely on in the past. Why is now a really good time to be having these kinds of big policy discussions compared to, during any regular time of politics?
Well, you mentioned immigration, Ebony. Immigration policy changed without Australians much knowing about it. The immigration policy that we debated was about asylum seekers, a tiny proportion of population growth. But what affected the economy, what affected living standards of Australians was a shift in immigration policy away from the successful post-war emphasis on permanent migration, where people coming to Australia as immigrants came on a path to citizenship, on a confident path to citizenship. And they absorbed an Australian orientation from an early stage. That changed a couple of decades ago, and the emphasis shifted to temporary migration, a lot of it relatively unskilled, although it was presented as being skilled migration. In fact, it wasn't. And the temporary migration became very large, became a big pressure for downward, a source of downward pressure on wages for relatively unskilled people in rural and in urban areas. And all of that happened without much discussion in Australia. Now, immigration stopped. It actually was a little bit negative last year, and it's not going to be very positive this year. Things have changed, been put on hold by the pandemic. That makes that a good time to reassess immigration policy and its effects on the economy. I'm suggesting that we should return to immigration, but to a moderate level, and again with an emphasis on permanent migration rather than temporary migration. The other reason why it's a good time to sit and look is that the emergency led to the breaking of a lot of shibboleths on policy. We had a lot of emphasis on the primacy of removing debt and deficit during the dog days. It was misplaced, but now all of that's been broken aside. We've got the highest deficits we've ever had in our peacetime history. So that creates an environment in which we can think about what is really the appropriate level of debt and deficit. Similarly, in monetary policy, during the dog days, Australia ran tighter monetary policy than the rest of the developed world, even though we didn't have a stronger economy than the rest of the developed world. I compare what happened in the US with Australia. Australia entered the dog days with much lower unemployment than the US because we hadn't had a recession during the global financial crisis. The US had a deep recession because they didn't have such expansionary policies as we did. They started with much higher unemployment than us in 2013. But by 2019, they had much lower unemployment by us, and we were still stuck at the same unemployment level we had in 2013. The difference, well, a number of differences, but the biggest difference was monetary policy. They quickly reduced, Federal Reserve quickly reduced interest rates set by the bank, short-term rates down to near zero, and kept them there until unemployment was significantly lower than Australia's rate of unemployment, whereas we jacked up rates and kept them higher than the rest of the developed world. That kept the exchange rate high, made our export industries uncompetitive, and was a big headwind against recovery.
Yeah, Richard, I might come to you now. Ross, I will ask if you can mute yourself so we can try and limit this feedback. I'm sorry about this problem. Thank you. Richard, coming to you now, I just want to talk about the moment that we find ourselves in and why this time of, you know, crisis when a lot of things have been upended, as Ross said, a lot of the old shibboleths kind of went by the wayside very quickly. Why is now a good time to be making big changes and big reforms?
Yeah, thanks, Eb, and thanks, Ross. Sorry about the feedback. I hope it's a bit better now. All my fault. We talk so much about the economy in Australia. We talk so much about economic policy that it's rare we get the opportunity, unfortunately, to step back and ask big, interesting questions. And Ross does a great job of that in this book and provides a lot of interesting answers as well. But in terms of why now? Well, let's start at the beginning. Economics is about the efficient allocation of scarce resources. What we want to do is organise all of our resources as efficiently as we can so we can make as much of the stuff that we want the most. I mean, that's really what we're trying to do in economics. So when you've got a million people who don't have work, giving them work to do is about the most efficient thing you can do. Like, the most inefficient thing you can do is sit by while a million people wait for someone else to create a job. So we're at this wonderful point and terrible point in economic history, because the crisis has created all this spare labour. It's actually in our economic interests as well as our social interests to actually employ that labour. And if, as Ross suggests, that we make a lot of that investment into things like renewable energy, we don't just help our economy and help inequality and society. We actually help the economy, because we help the environment, because what we come out of this pandemic crisis with is a whole bunch of stuff that we're going to be able to use for decades to come. So unfortunately, and I'm interested in Ross's thoughts on this, but so much of what passes for commentary or analysis of economic policy in Australia is just kind of some aping of something we did 20 or 30 years ago. And I think one of the most interesting things about Ross's book is he says, look at what happened in those early Hawke Keating years, and it worked then. But what we see 30 years later is people still kind of trying to do the same stuff or say the same magic words and hoping that it will work in an entirely different setting. So I think the obvious example is industrial relations reform. We did a lot of industrial relations reform in the 90s, a lot of it under Labor, some of it under the coalition, and some of that needed to happen. But we kind of think that just doing it again and again and again for decades, we keep expecting the same big outcomes. And as Ross makes clear in the book, that's not happening. So I think we need to have quite a different conversation about what happened in the good old days, because I don't think what we need to do today is copy what we did back then. What we need to copy is the idea that we can actually do new things. We can roll out big new things that are a bit unconventional, that disrupt some of the status quo. That's the lesson that we need to take out of the 80s, not, oh, we did IR reform then, so we should do it again now, or we cut the company tax rate then, so we should do it again now. All of the big reforms that happened in that sort of golden era that Ross is describing, all of them were controversial. All of them disrupted things. All of them upset power. All of them upset the status quo. That's what changing the economy feels like. Whereas today we have this kind of nonsensical conversation about giving business certainty, which is the exact opposite of what those big reforms were doing. What those big reforms were doing was opening Australia up to a whole bunch of risk and opportunity. But, you know, we've got a very, very lazy corporate culture in Australia today that's very profitable, often sitting on top of very big oligopolies. The last thing they want is genuine economic reform. That's why they're obsessed with getting their wage costs down by 1% or their tax rate down by 2%. That means they can just sit on top of their oligopoly profits and let government, pump a little bit more in.
Ross, did you want to respond to that?
Yeah, lots of points there from Richard. I'll start with the first one, the importance of full employment. You said that I said it's important to restore full employment. I didn't actually say that. I said it's important to achieve full employment, because we didn't have it before the pandemic recession. It's a long time since we have had it. In fact, we nearly had it on the eve of the global financial crisis. We had unemployment down to 4%, but even then there was no sign of inflationary pressures in the labour market. So we know that we could have gone lower than that, and would have, I think, if the GFC hadn't hit. We had full employment in the 50s and 60s and the beginning of the 70s, and measured unemployment was mostly less than 2%, 1.5%. People who wanted a job would quickly find one, lots of advantages of that for our society. So I'm saying we should achieve full employment and not restore full employment, because restoring full employment means going back half a century. I think that is has to be a central objective for the reasons that Richard says. It's an awful waste of economic opportunity to have all those people wanting to be productive in the society and economy and not being able to. And at the same time, it's dreadful in its social implications and implications for income distribution. So a strong emphasis on full employment. And I, in the book, I've got a whole chapter on full employment, and I say that we won't have full employment until we see pressures for upward movement of wages in the labour market. And you can't work that out theoretically. You know you're there when you're there. And the Reserve Bank the government through the dog days seem to have in their minds that we were more or less at full employment with unemployment of 5 point something, which we were at that time. Well, we know that full employment wasn't there, that we weren't even reaching our inflation targets. Unemployment definitely lower than that. Belatedly, the Reserve Bank started to recognise that in 2019 and started talking about 4.5% being full employment. But that's still just a modelling outcome, a theoretical construct. We've got to find out what full employment is by continuing expanding employment until wages start to rise. That's really the centrepiece of our objectives. And incomes can start rising once we've got full employment, so long as we've made investments in the industries in the future. And that's where the superpower narrative joins the narrative of increasing prosperity. And no point in creating jobs in, not much point in creating jobs in investment in industries that won't be prosperous in the 2030s and 2040s. An investment now in, say, in coal production or coal use will create jobs now, just like John Maynard Keynes in his great book, The General Theory on Employment, Incomes and Money, said that you do some good for employment by burying banknotes and getting people to dig them up. That's the advantage you'd get from investment in coal now. It might be better than nothing, but nowhere as good as investing in something that's going to create jobs and rising incomes in the 30s and 40s. And you have to think ahead to the industries that will be flourishing in the 30s and 40s. And in these days when the US president, the Prime Minister of Britain, all of the main leaders of the European Union, the leaders of Japan, Korea, China, the non-EU member countries in Europe are all committed to zero emissions around the middle of the century. I could add New Zealand and Canada to that. We're the odd country out amongst developed countries. In that world, the zero emissions world that everyone else is moving towards now that you've had the change in the United States, to be productive in future, investment now has to be in zero emissions industries.
Yeah, so we've got more than 1,500 people on the line with us today. Thank you so much for joining us. I'll come to questions from the audience in just a second. But just before we do go to that, Ross, I was, I guess, struck by the very hopeful tone that the book strikes overall, but particularly at the end you were talking about how during the pandemic, Australians really turned to knowledge for guidance, and that our democratic institutions and our government seemed to fare much better during the immediate public health crisis. I just wonder if you could comment on that and why you thought that was important to emphasise in the book, and, you know, how well Australia did compared to, say, the UK and the United States.
Yeah, and I'll go back to Richard's comments, very important comments, that drawing the right lessons from the successful economic policies of the 80s doesn't mean going back exactly to the same agenda as that time. But what we can go back to in drawing lessons from successful periods in Australian economic policy, and I emphasise two, one was post-war reconstruction. We faced a very big challenge demobilising a huge defence force and reorienting industry away from arms production. That was a huge adjustment after the Second World War, and we faced another big adjustment in the 80s as we faced up to the stagnation of incomes, inflation and high unemployment, the issues that the Hawke government had to address. From both those periods, the lessons I draw are first that successful economic policy in our democracy got to be based on, first of all, on knowledge. The leaders of the community have to be open to knowledge and has to be broadly shared knowledge. You have to talk about these things and the community has to share knowledge. Secondly, one strong lesson from those periods and also from those parts of economic policy that worked on our way out of the Great Depression under the Lyons government is that in our democratic polity, you don't get community buy-in to structural change unless there's widespread acceptance and understanding in the community that what's being done will bring benefits for the country as a whole, but also equitable sharing of those benefits. And the successful periods of economic policy in Australia have been within a social democratic framework. And I'd include the many elements of the approach of the Menzies government, continuing those of the Curtin and Chipley governments with a strong emphasis on equity. We won't make the big changes that we need to make unless we do that. And so the lessons from the successful periods of Australian economic policy are, first, you've got to use knowledge effectively. Second, you've got to have a strong focus on equity. One of the things that's changed in Australia and in the developed world in the 21st century is we've downgraded the role of knowledge. I've got a chapter called The Tree of Knowledge about that sad phenomenon. It's dragging down our democracies. It's what should be an advantage of democracy, that it allows knowledge to be highly influential, has for the time being become a disadvantage because we've had a systematic denial of knowledge in many areas, in health, in climate policy, in economic policy, in international relations. That's gone further in some countries than others. Sadly, it had gone so far in the United States under President Trump, with his supporters in News Corp and other parts of the establishment in the United States. It's gone so far in the United States with Trump and sadly in the UK that it became habitual to deny scientific knowledge. And so the things that could have been done quickly to blunt the damage from the pandemic weren't done. Yeah. As a result, our English-speaking friends in the Northern Hemisphere suffered great damage. Well, it is a mercy that the denial of knowledge has not gone as far in Australia as in the US. We did respect knowledge in relation to the pandemic, and we got good results as a result. Australian management of the crisis has led to much less sickness, much less death than in the US and the UK.
Yeah.
And that's respect for knowledge is an important element of that. If we take that renewed respect for knowledge into other spheres like economic policy and climate policy, and then we've got a chance of achieving full employment and rising incomes.
Richard, I might come to you for a response to that, and then we'll go to questions from the audience.
Yeah, look, just 2 points there that I want to kind of expand on that Ross made. First, yeah, we went through, and most developed countries did, post World War II, this incredible post-war demobilization, which if we think about it, you know, it was hundreds of thousands of people directly involved in the war effort, hundreds of thousands more involved in supporting them. And they were often young men and they were going to come back and need work. And we did it. Like, we actually transformed the economy to fight a war, which was an enormous feat. And then we transformed the economy very quickly away from fighting a war to building infrastructure and building housing. So we could do that in the 1950s, and we didn't even have a smartphone to help contact people. So the idea that that's harder to do today is of course, ridiculous. It's about creativity and confidence, not capacity. And the other thing in terms of drawing on knowledge, I think we have to be really careful. One thing we know with recessions is the first thing that happens is firms stop employing new people, and a lot of the new hires are young. So we know young people are going to get hit hardest by this recession in the medium term. Like, we know who got thrown out of their jobs straight away, disproportionately casual, disproportionately women. But what we don't notice as much is the new entrants to the labour market, primarily young people, finishing school, finishing uni, we're just not employing them. And it takes years before they can actually push their way back into the labour market. We know this is true. We know this is happening. It's not as emotional or spectacular as watching other groups of people get sacked, but watching young people come out of school and come out of uni and just quietly, invisibly not getting a job is a terrible thing. And again, you know, I think if we want to draw on the tree of knowledge that Ross refers to, we know that young people bear the brunt of this pain. What better time to be giving them free education? What better time to be making university courses cheaper or even free, even if it's only temporary, to say to these young people, look, we know there's no work for you at the moment, but at least let us give you all the other things that you might be able to benefit from. But, of course, we're not doing that. We're coming up with hotlines to dob in doll bludgers. It's obscene, and history tells us, you know, yeah, we need to look back at that tree of knowledge.
Yeah, thanks, Richard. I'll go to questions from the audience now. The first one is from Daryl Fallow. He says, the government seems intent on a gas-led recovery, which seems to be largely a subsidy to the gas industry. And their argument is renewables probably don't need subsidies. What would your alternative priority areas be for spending the money that the government intends to spend on expanding gas?
Yeah, the emphasis on gas is misplaced. We are not going to have globally competitive prices for gas. We could have had it with export reservation, but the government doesn't seem to be enthusiastic about that. If we don't have globally competitive prices for gas in Eastern Australia, then we're not going to have new investment in gas export industries, processing industries based on gas. So it's simply economically not feasible to expect much in the way of investment in gas. And in the new world that's emerging, a very strong commitment to zero emissions, the fact that gas is not a zero emissions industrial feedstock or fuel counts strongly against it. Sure, it's better than coal, half the emissions if you burn it for electricity of coal, but still high emissions unless you capture the carbon dioxide emissions and take them out of the atmosphere permanently. Now, you can do that technically, and I think we should be looking at doing everything we can to do that, exploring those technologies. But it's not going to be cheap, and so it's not going to be competitive with zero emissions manufacturing. So it's not a path to the future. There might be some niches where it's important, and let's use those, but it's not going to be a big story. So for all of those reasons, emphasis on gas as a basis of recovery is misplaced. On the other hand, positioning ourselves to be the natural supplier of zero emissions manufactured goods to the world has very strong foundation. To achieve strong results from that, I put a lot of emphasis initially on government support for innovation in the new technologies in industry. In the early days of building renewable energy capacity in Australia, we had for a couple of years a carbon price that was very successful in all of its objectives. But we also set up the Australian Renewable Energy Agency, the Clean Energy Finance Corporation, which supported the new technologies. To its credit, the government is expanding the role of the Renewable Energy Agency to support for industries using zero emissions inputs, using renewable energy. Some of the other proposed extensions of the mandate are less laudable, but certainly that element is valid. But we're doing that on a tiny scale. The US has said that it will commit $1.7 trillion to the zero emissions transformation. Scaling that back on a per capita basis, that's $50 billion or more a year in Australia over the next few years. What we're putting into the support for the new industries for innovation is trivial compared with that. I just saw an announcement in France that the French government is going to make a major commitment towards supporting the first hydrogen-based zero emissions iron processing in France. Well, economically, for the world as a whole, much more efficient for that to be in Australia. But if the French government is paying for the innovation and the Australian government is not, then it'll happen in France. So the very first thing I do is make sure that we've got support, fiscal support for innovation comparable with what's going on in France, in Germany, in Britain, in Korea, Japan, China, the United States, Canada. Now, it would be much more successful, would go much more smoothly and quickly if we had a carbon price. But I've taken the position that the horrible political history of carbon pricing in Australia has poisoned that well for the time being. It's still there, a well of sweet water, but it's been poisoned. Sooner we can get rid of the toxins and get back to using it, the better. But I don't think that'll be very easy very quickly. But there's one thing we can do, and that's establish price incentives for sequestration of carbon in the soils and land. And I suggest in the book that we could do that by requiring fugitive emissions, emissions that are produced incidentally alongside coal production and natural gas production, to be offset by purchase of offsets from Australian farmers.
Yeah, thanks for that. Richard, did you have any response to that question?
When Ross talks big numbers like that, it's easy in Australia to say, we'll never do anything like that. That's not how we roll. Yes, it is. We're in the middle of spending $200 billion, $200,000 million to build 12 new submarines to replace the 6 we haven't sent to war yet. $200 billion. And when pushed on, is that a lot of money? We hear, it'll create jobs and all, there'll be technology. So we love spending large amounts of money on big things in Australia. We just haven't wanted to do it in relation to climate change. And of course, the ultimate irony is that the Conservatives in Australia, the ones who rage against the cost of renewable energy, you wave a bit of nuclear energy in front of them and they go crazy with, it doesn't matter how much we spend. If we could tackle climate change spending far more on nuclear energy, I'd be into it like a rat up a drainpipe. So we'd have to be clear what deliberate, appalling decision-making is kind of driving this in Australia. We're one of the richest countries in the world. We spend enormous amounts of money on speculative things like submarines. And I'm not anti-submarines. I just think that, if you think they're going to deliver world peace, you're crazy. We're told, we can't invest $200 billion in renewable energy because it won't guarantee a safe climate. Well, submarines won't guarantee a safe Australia. $200 billion invested in renewables won't save climate change, but by gee, it'll take us a long way. It'll set us up for the future. And again, the people who say, oh, we need to be fiscally responsible, whatever that means, or we can't do it, the same people drop all those objections when you say, would it be okay if we took a speculative bet on nuclear? So it's a policy choice to not do what Ross is saying. It's not that they don't know. It's that they really want to do anything else.
Yeah. Thanks, Richard. The next question, and I've actually got a couple of questions on this theme, Ross, is from Diane Wicks or Weeks. She says, I'm very interested in Ross's vision for a universal basic income and what that would achieve.
Yeah. The problem I'm seeking to address is a very large disincentive to labour force participation that comes from the interaction of income tax and the withdrawal of social security benefits as you earn income. And try as we might to address this issue by small incremental things, we've still ended up with dreadful poverty traps. So lots of circumstances in which someone who's on unemployment benefits or other social security payments loses a lot, sometimes all, of the incremental income as they take a decision to go into paid employment have those benefits withdrawn. So that's the essential purpose of integrating the tax and social security systems by replacing them with a universal basic income payment. I've got a lot of details of that in the chapter and on that subject, and I don't have time to go into all of that now. But you'd give up the idea that bureaucrats should be hounding people to look for jobs that may not be there, taking a lot of the time of hardworking people in companies evaluating employment applications for jobs that aren't there. Centrelink can see its role as actually helping people find jobs rather than hounding them for not looking hard enough. Put this in place, and the time when this yields benefits is when we've got genuine full employment. So people are working when they want to, for the number of hours they want to. It becomes a top-up for low incomes, and it takes pressure on the living off the living standards of people who are earning relatively low incomes in the labour market, and including the young people, the second earners in households, people with relatively low skills, not so valuable skills in the labour market that have been hit hardest by the pandemic, and were hit very hard by the stagnation of the dog days. So I see it as being very important for increasing labour force participation. That's good for the economy as well as for equity. I see it as very important in providing some boost to incomes amongst people who are earning relatively low incomes in the labour market.
I've got a couple of questions here, and we've only got 10 minutes left, so I don't necessarily want to get into a huge technical explanation, but you do have a chapter here that a couple of people are asking about replacing corporate income tax with a tax on cash flows. The Australia Institute did a lot of work kind of challenging that race to the bottom on cutting company taxes. Can you just outline for us what your proposal is in the book there?
Yes, Ebony, and it can quickly get technical. I've explained it in a lot of words in that chapter in the book, and I hope it's clear there. But I'll explain the outcome. The outcome is a tax system that's not vulnerable to a race to the bottom, because you're effectively removing corporate tax on truly competitive industries. They're the industries where corporate tax could inhibit investment in Australia. But you're increasing the tax actually paid, not necessarily the tax rate, the tax actually paid in oligopolistic industries and industries using rents, earning rents. It would be very effective in taxing the tech companies that are now very important parts of our economy. We spend a lot of our incomes one way or another on IT services. Very large incomes in those companies, but they don't pay tax in Australia. They charge fees for use of their intellectual property that offsets the income they earn, and the income goes back. The rents for use of their IP goes back to a tax haven. They don't even pay tax in their home country. So it's very effective in shifting the tax burden away from companies operating in a competitive environment towards companies operating in an oligopolistic environment. It shifts the tax burden away from companies that are investing a lot towards companies that are sitting on their laurels. It shifts the tax burden away from new companies towards companies with established profits. It shifts the tax burden away from companies taking risks and innovating towards companies just sitting on their laurels. All the technical details are in that chapter. I think I've explained it fairly simply, but I've explained it in a fair few words.
That's great. Thank you. Richard, did you want to respond to that as someone who worked a lot on that company tax research?
Yeah, look, I guess, again, I sort of make the point that we're kind of just stuck in the past in Australia. We've kind of we've got these fairy tale stories we like to tell ourselves, and one of them is the sort of tax reforms we did in the 80s as some sort of golden era, or implementing the GST was sort of the high watermark of tax reform in Australia. What we need to do is step back and think, what's the purpose of collecting tax? Why are we collecting tax? Who do we want to collect it from? What do we think is fair? And the reality is that because our tax system is basically a sitting target, big new companies that have evolved in the last 20 or 30 years, the Facebooks, the Googles are the most obvious ones, Apple. Like, from day one when the companies were set up, they were set up to anticipate how to get around tax laws, like in countries like in Australia. So whether or not it's moving towards a transaction tax, as Ross described, whether it's other mechanisms for getting multinational companies to pay tax by not sort of setting up these effectively sham agreements where the little Australian enterprise just takes all of its revenue and gives it to an enterprise in a tax haven and says it was to buy intellectual property. What we have to do is just step back and say, are the companies that we think should be paying enough tax paying enough tax? And unfortunately, our vision is so blinkered by decisions that made sense in 1975 or 1987 that they just get in the way of genuine economic debate, and more importantly, genuine democratic debate about how, of all the ways that we can collect tax in Australia, what do we think would be fairest? What do we think would be most efficient? These are important conversations, and we've either said to have them will ruin the economy because it'll scare off foreign investors. That's rubbish. Or if we change, we can only change in very narrow windows, like should we cut the company tax rate? We need to have a much bigger conversation. And again, I think that's good economics and good democratic reform.
Thanks, Richard. We're almost out of time, but I think we've got time for one last question. This is from Parviz Dima, who asks, how do we deal with the growing economic inequality in Australia and its long-term effects on social cohesion? It'll have to be a brief response there, Ross, sorry.
Well, in my book, I emphasise three things: genuine full employment and rising incomes, rising wages following full employment. Secondly, the minimum basic income. And thirdly, the corporate tax reform. These three things will be very helpful. Now, they're not the whole story. Other books are necessary to tell a bigger story about income inequality. But these three things that I talk about will make good progress.
And just before we do finish up, I noticed that the book is dedicated to the memory of Papua New Guinea's first Secretary of Treasury and Finance and Governor of the Bank of Papua New Guinea. I just wondered if you could tell us a little bit about that person and why you've put that in the memoriam.
Yeah, Makiri Murata, we've been close friends since we met when he was a student in the very first year of the University of Papua New Guinea back in 1966. Close friends I made in that time have been lifelong friends. Makeri, when he was appointed Secretary for Treasury before independence, the first Papua New Guinean Secretary for Treasury, asked me to come in and work with him as his deputy. And that was one of the professional highlights of my life. He, as I said in his eulogy, which is on the web, he dedicated his life to good governance. And over time, sadly, that became a struggle to overcome corruption and to try to maintain probity in public affairs. But he never gave up. He never gave up even when in his last months, when because of COVID, my wife Jane and I were living in the middle of Queensland. So I was able to travel from the bush of Queensland to see him a few times. And then, in pain and in distress from cancer, the things he still wanted to talk about were how a poor developing country like Papua New Guinea could implement policies in the interests of the welfare of all people against very strong pressures for corruption of the political processes. So very big personal loss for me, a huge loss for Papua New Guinea, but a life lived well. As I said in the eulogy, although the things he built later were dragged down by other people, they proved forever that they could be built.
Well, I'm very sorry for your loss, and thank you for sharing those memories of him. And thank you for the book. I'll just hold it up again here. It's Reset by Ross Garnaut, Restoring Australia After the Pandemic Recession. It's available from all good bookstores. Thank you so much for joining us today, Professor Ross Garnaut and Richard Dennis. Thank you, everyone, for your great questions. I'm really sorry we can never get to all of them. They're always so good. But if we didn't answer your question, the answer is probably here in this book. So race out and grab it now.
This has been a special webinar episode of Follow the Money. All of our webinars are free and available to view on our YouTube channel, which you can find and subscribe to at australiainstitute.tv. All our latest research and content is at australiainstitute.org.au, and you can find us on Twitter at the Oz Institute with an AUS. My Twitter handle is Ebony_Bennett with a double N double T, and you can find our producer Jennifer Macy at Jennifer Macy. Our theme music is by Jonathan McFeet from Pulse and Thrum, with additional music by Blue Dot Sessions. Stay safe out there, everyone, and thanks for listening.